Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Last week we said Happy Thanksgiving, and today I'm going to say I hope you made out like a bandit on Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and there was something also on Saturday.
Well, Cyber Monday, isn't Cyber Monday tomorrow?
Oh, that's right.
What's
on Saturday?
So there's some other deal. You still have time to rev up. Still have time for another couple of bowls of turkey soup. and let's get on with today's program.
Today's ethnic. We're doing an ethnic mix, which I think is exciting this time of the year because you're in a mood to explore and get excited. So anyhow, we're starting with... I always say this is a cuisine on the rise, but it's been centuries and centuries old, so I don't know where it's going, but it's Indian as apple pie. Well, Indian for everyone. You know, I think you caught it in the title, Anupi Singla. I found so much good advice in this book that I might be tempted to even try Indian cooking at home.
Again.
All right. Well, then we hit our mark. Yep. I appreciate that.
And it's subtitled The Home Cook's Guide to Traditional Favorites. In other words, you're making it easy for all of us to be able to recreate these Indian recipes.
I am. And the point of the book is to say sometimes folks, if they're looking at a cuisine that's really new to them, really only need a little bit of hand-holding. Mm-hmm. And they just need somebody there that has that ability to teach them what are the key ingredients or the key things that you need to have in your kitchen. And once you get those, Indian food is one of the easiest and healthiest to make on the planet. So it's really not a far stretch to say that anybody can make Indian food.
Well, now, you point out all the people who would benefit from this book in your introduction. And then you really launch into it. I thought I knew, and I've certainly read enough Indian cookbooks, I thought I knew a lot of these ingredients, and you've come up with even spices that I didn't know.
Well, the thing is with Indian food that many folks don't know is that they often start with curry powder. We really don't even use curry powder, and if they know that already, they will use some of those basic spices, but they're not as comfortable with going the next step, and that's really what I'm doing with my whole platform, with my books and with my products, is I'm teaching folks how to take it from that basic step and then take it one step further and make those spices either at home or purchase the right spice blends that you need to replicate those dishes you're eating out at the restaurant. So, for example, chickpeas in a curried broth is called chana masala, but the key to that is a spice blend that's also called chana masala. I have the ingredient for making that spice blend in the book, but I also have options for you to go to an Indian grocery store and pick up that blend or go onto my website and pick up that blend as well. So there's lots of ways to do it, but you really do need to have the specific blends to get that same sort of authentic flavor that you're getting at the restaurants.
Now, hold on a second. Let's just make sure that listeners got that, because they might not have woken up to that just yet.
Oh, no worries.
So let me underline the fact, not only do you tell them what to buy, but you also give them a place to go to get it.
Well, that's kind of the journalist in me that is speaking at that point, because I am a busy mom with children that are 9 and 11 years old, and
wow.
I promise they're moving backwards in age sometimes. I feel like they're getting younger, their needs are getting even more deeper, and so I don't have the time, if I was going to start learning a new cuisine, to sit there and navigate the world of spices and gather everything. So I just want to make it easier for moms and dads. I also want to make it easier for anybody just picking up the book to be able to go to one spot, and it's a spot that you know you can trust, because I come from everything from a journalist's point of view where I'm not going to sell you something that I really don't think that you're going to need. It's going to add value to what you're doing in your day. So absolutely, I believe in one click, and you've got everything you want. So on my website, the way it's set up is you can buy the books, but you can also buy the basic set of spices together or separate if you need them, or the spice blends together in sets of six. So of different types of spices in that set. So you can take it from the basic to the little bit more interesting, complicated, and more unique, or you can keep it at the basic if you want. So there are lots of different options for what you're looking for.
Yeah, well, there's so many things going on with these spices. And what I want to get in here that I fully intend to try your mom's morning cleanse, which really looked healthy to me. But I want to also talk a little bit about how few people really recognize the health benefits of some of these spices that Indian culture has used for centuries.
Well, it's an amazing thing once you actually understand some of the benefits. For example, turmeric is a very, very hot spice right now, and I don't mean hot as in spicy, but it is blowing up. Everyone's starting to understand the benefits, the health benefits. Now, it has an ingredient element in there called curcumin. The curcumin, they believe, and they're still testing it, actually pushes off memory loss. It might actually help prevent Alzheimer's. So if you look at the percentage of Alzheimer's growth in the West versus in Asia, it's exponentially higher in the West than it is in Asia. So there are great ways to get turmeric into your diet. The best way is to get it into your food, because the key with turmeric, just like vitamins, is that your body truly only absorbs a certain percentage of what you're taking in at that one time. So if you're taking a pill, that's great, but you're probably going to be eliminating a great amount of that turmeric from the pills. So why not get it into your diet slowly, into your day, into your meals? And that's how Indians eat. We eat turmeric in our day from morning until the evening, in salads, in lentil dishes, in quick stir fries, in our curries. So that's just one example. Cumin helps prevent heart disease and diabetes. Fenugreek seeds, which is in that morning cleanse that you were talking about.
That really got me, because I love fenugreek. I mean, that.
And it's a fantastic little seed. It has a bitter note. Bitter food is actually incredibly healthy for you. So the first time you eat it, you might kind of wrinkle your nose a little bit. But now I have my little kids eating and drinking that cleanse in the morning, and they're addicted to the fenugreek seeds. So you can do it just by adding it into your diet slowly and getting used to it on a day-to-day basis.
Now, I was reading a book about Indian cooking somewhere, and it seemed to me that I read, and it was something that really surprised me, that you use also the leaves of the fenugreek plant. Now, was I mistaken, or is that correct?
You're absolutely correct, and we use it in two different ways. One way is fresh. So if we're making a quick stir fry, we'll throw in some fenugreek, fresh fenugreek leaves. Often we'll make even carrots into a stir fry. It's just a fun, funky way, I guess, to use your fenugreek leaves. But then also we use them dried, and especially the region that I'm from in India, Punjab, it's noted for its fiery curries. And we love adding that layer of fenugreek into dishes. You add the health component, but you also add this really interesting deep taste profile. And when folks don't know about that, they don't add it to their food, and they think they're not making the food correctly. So that's what I'm doing in my book, is I'm not saying that you can make Indian food with three spices only, or giving you this sort of quick take on Indian. You must invest in the proper spices and the proper ingredients. But once you do, they're used over and over and over again, to the point where you don't really need to go shopping as much anymore. And once you invest in the spices, you actually use your basic ingredients like ginger, garlic, onion, and tomatoes. And that's just used over and over again. You swap out the main ingredient. So it becomes a really economically easy and cheap way to eat, but a really healthy way to eat.
We met a chef, an Indian chef, who was in Houston, I think.
I knew you were going to tell your potato story. I just looked it up. It's not in here.
She made the most amazing potatoes.
With fenugreek.
And I asked her what the secret ingredient was, and she said it was fenugreek. And I've used it the same way in making potatoes myself. I think it's just really absolutely outstanding. Other people have told us that it's not proper to say there is an Indian cuisine, because India is such a huge country with a population well above a billion people. So, in fact, there's Indian regional cooking, which is as different as chalk and cheese from one end of the continent to the other.
That's so true. And it's not because there's so many people in India that there's the diversity. It's really because of the regional differences. And there are so many different ways of making and eating foods. I'll give you one simple example. So I'm from the north of India, and we typically use as our base spice cumin seed. But if you go towards the south part of India, they're going to use more of the mustard seed as their base. So if you're in North India, they're using cilantro as their herb. And in South India, they're using a leaf called curry leaf, which has nothing to do with curry powder, but they're using curry leaf as that herb alternative.
I tried to grow that. That's impossible to grow.
Yeah, we tried it. We had success once, and we liked it, and then we never could get it to grow again.
And it's an amazing herb to add to your dishes. It just gives you a whole new flavor profile, even better than lemongrass, actually. It's similar to lemongrass. But those are some of the basic differences. And I think that's the new wave of Indian food in America and in the West, is finally appreciating and celebrating the differences in regionalized cooking. And we're seeing restaurants pop up around the country that showcase and celebrate, for example, cuisine from Kerala, the Malabar coast, that uses a lot of coconut milk because that's where coconuts are grown, or also doesn't have any breads like naan and roti because they eat mostly rice. That's where the rice paddies are. But then you go to Punjab, where I'm from, and we're eating a lot of rotis and parantas, which are the breads that come from the wheat that's grown right there in Punjab. So those regional differences, once we in the South Asian community start to appreciate them and talk about them, will start to grow in the U.S. as well, and we're starting to finally see that.
And you actually represent this variety in your book, and one story you tell in the book, because we once had a whole house full of people, everyone with different tastes. I loved your description of a family gathering that was total chaos with all your different relatives. You yourself are vegan, and your mother is vegetarian, and somebody else is a vegetarian but eats eggs, and your husband likes meat. I've been in that situation. And you sort of try to represent that what you could do potentially with your recipes, making them appeal to all these different varieties of people. You can tell them.
Yeah, and that was the point of the book. I, first of all, do not believe in food labels. I really, truly believe that everyone should be able to sit at my kitchen table and feel comfortable and welcome no matter who they are. And they should focus on how delicious the food is rather than, oh, this is vegetarian. Oh, this is meat. I just don't like food labels. I've eaten vegan for 25 years. And so this is not a new sort of trend for me. I just embrace that, but I tend not to really chat about it or talk about it much because I don't think it describes me completely. I just love good food. And so I prefer, and I lean vegan because I don't love the taste of meat. And so I chose that route, but that doesn't mean that everyone else has to, just
right.
because I chose to go that route.
You have recipes that are totally unexpected in here, not lamb kebabs, tamarind shrimp curry and Kerala fish curry, a lot of poultry and fish recipes that you don't really expect.
Yes, and that's for my husband. He's the guy that eats anything that moves, and I always say that it's okay, we make it work. And I really think in the whole vegan space, if more people were really honest that, you know what, their days are not absolutely perfect every single day, we'd have more people discussing the benefits of just getting more fruits and vegetables into your day rather than, are you vegan? Are you not vegan? And so I just like to be really honest that just because I say I'm vegan doesn't mean that one day I can't have a bite of yogurt and all of a sudden the clouds have parted and I've sinned. I don't like to put that kind of pressure on myself or anyone else. I think you get through your days the way you can. Some days are more hectic. Some days are lighter and easier to kind of eat the way you want. And I just wrote a book where now the tandoori chicken recipe, I can show you how I make it at home. I make one batch for my husband and his friends, and I make another batch for myself that is made with baked tofu. And so that's just how we roll in this house, and I'm not saying anyone else has to believe in it or do it, but I just think it'll just take the pressure off when people pick up this book and realize you can feed everyone with this book.
Yeah, that's one of the points I really wanted to get across. And I like the fact that you use vegetables. You cook them one night for dinner, and then you put them in your kids' sandwiches the next day, which my favorite sandwich is an eggplant sandwich.
Yes, we do that with Indian food all the time, and we put it into our breads. We cook flatbread all the time, and I take the dal or the lentils that I cook one night, and it goes right into that from the next day, and they have no idea that I've recycled it, but they just like it.
Yeah, well, another thing, people who love lentils or any kind of pulses, and beans, that there are a million different tips about those in this book, which Peter makes me lentils. I think he's going to be looking through this book. He makes me lentils for breakfast. I like soft-boiled eggs with lentils.
Oh, that sounds so yummy. Absolutely. And that's the beauty of Indian food is there's so much variety, and it's spice. If you spice it just right, I always say most folks that are not used to an Indian diet believe that things like lentils, legumes, peas are actually boring, but they only think they're boring because they haven't had them prepped the way we prep it. My kids grew up on an Indian diet. I really quit my job as a reporter to teach them how to eat, and I find that they really gravitate towards the lentils. I mean, if it's made, that's what they want. They might eat a slice of pizza, but then they're back to your one slice. Mom, can we just have a bowl of lentils? It's wholesome, it's nourishing, and it really fills you up because it's giving you the nutrition that your body actually needs. And my 9-year-old's standing in front of me making motions that she's hungry now that I've been talking about lentils.
Please take care of your 9-year-old before he or she dies.
Everything is death, or it's always so. Yeah, all the faces are moving, but no one ever actually suffers from missing a meal here, so it's all good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, it's a very useful book, and I cannot recommend it highly enough, actually. I keep looking at your photographs. They're gorgeous, too. They make me hungry as well. Good luck with your book, Anupi, and with the next one. I'm sure there will be a next one. Folks, check out her website. Remember, Indian is apple pie.
Book tour dates are on there, too. I'll be going to Philly and to Seattle, Vancouver in November, and then we'll be traveling even more next year. And I always have Chicago events, so I hope people will check out those dates and come and see me in person.
I think so.
Thank you to you both.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I was going to say that we are actually moving from one continent to another, but that's actually not true. But we are going, instead of from the middle of a continent and its own subcontinent, to the very eastern edge of the continent of Asia and the country of Lebanon and the city of Beirut.
Now that's my husband, the geographer, explaining all this. I've learned quite a lot, Jumana Akkad, about Beirut and Lebanese cooking. Your latest book is called Taste of Beirut, and I understand that you actually lived in Lebanon for 3 years in order to write this book.
Yes.
Now, your background is Lebanese, but you came to the United States as a young child.
I came to the U.S. as a young adult.
A young adult.
And I've been here ever since. My children were born here, grew up as full-blooded or Native Americans, but I've always kept that yearning for my heritage. And when I got into the food business, I felt that I really wanted to explore and teach people about Lebanese cuisine and in the authentic and traditional way. So I felt that it would be more honest on my part to go live there and cook with locals. And this is what I did for 3 years, and I just got back a couple weeks ago. So,
wow.
Yes.
What are some of the major misconceptions that Americans have about Lebanese food?
Maybe it's misconception would be too harsh. Let's say that it's an incomplete knowledge. For example, they may think Lebanese food is all about hummus and tabbouleh, which it may be in a large part, but that's not the whole picture.
Uh-huh.
And when you go to Lebanon, and for such a small country, it's only the size, let's say, of the state of Connecticut, and it's got 4 million or so people.
That's amazing. It's amazing what the impact on the food has.
Right. It's so disproportionate to think that such a small country, even if, as you travel the Middle East, if you go, for example, to Erbil, as I did, or to Dubai, you find that even the folks in those countries love Lebanese cuisine and try to you know, adopt it. So I wanted to find out, well, what is it about Lebanese cuisine that made it so special?
And what is it?
Well, I can tell you, I've divided my time while I was there between living in the mountain in our family property, where we still have an orchard and an olive grove, and we do the traditional foraging like folks in the mountains do, and Beirut, which is more of a cosmopolitan city. Now, Lebanese food is traditionally a food from the land. In other words, tabbouleh salad or fattoush or those the well-known mezze or appetizers were developed by people who had a frugal existence, and mostly people who lived in those mountain villages and who didn't have much except what their land could produce. And so they would go out and they would plant parsley, mint, and they would also use wild herbs and plants such as sumac. I mean, sumac in the mountains where I stay was all over, and people this time of year forage it, dry it, and mill it at the village mill, and they use the spice to add a little bit of sourness to their food.
Oh, is that what the sumac does? Okay.
Yes, it adds sourness because at a high altitude, as a farmer, you could not grow citrus. Citrus in Lebanon is mostly found on the coastline.
Oh, and is very essential to all Lebanese dishes.
Right, absolutely. So, okay, if you don't have access to lemons, what are you going to do? Well, you use sumac.
Okay.
Za'atar, another one that's all over, and people forage and dry and make into a za'atar mix.
Yeah, that's my favorite seasoning.
Oh, well, me too.
Lamb with za'atar. Oh, I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Za'atar is essential, and if you ask someone in the villages about it, he'll tell you, I will never buy za'atar. I make my own za'atar.
Oh, yeah.
So,
right.
Now, things like that.
Now, how about all the other Middle Eastern countries? How is Lebanese cuisine different?
It's different in that it relies on fresh and seasonal products that come from one's small plot. I mean, what's so funny is that even though traditionally people would come up with dishes from their plot, that's, for example, I had spent a lot of time with people from my in their 80s, and they remember the days when they lived off their plot of land. They grew their own wheat from which they made bulgur.
Yes.
And bulgur is used in kibbeh. It's also used in tabbouleh. It's used in hundreds of dishes. And they also had their little vegetable garden where they made the grape leaves. They made the tabbouleh. They made all these dishes that are vegetable and herb-based.
Yes, you said that you maybe a typical Lebanese family would maybe have meat once a week.
Well, this I wanted to focus on tradition. Of course, today an urbanized Lebanese would live as someone would live in Dallas,
right.
Texas. You
which
know,
is where you live.
it's become food has become a global thing. But if you look at tradition, yes. They used to slaughter, and in fact, in the village where I stayed, in the Shouf Mountains, the butcher that I spent time talking to and I would buy meat from, he would do his butchering once a week, twice a week if there was more demand. But that was it.
Yeah.
And he gets... something that people don't know is that most of the meat in Lebanon is imported from Brazil or Australia.
Oh.
However, you have goats. You have 500,000 goats that roam the Lebanese mountains. And traditionally, people used goat meat to make their kibbeh.
You know, I always think of kibbeh as being ground lamb balls, either raw or fried, and you have a dozen practically, kibbeh recipes that have nothing to do with meat at all.
Right, because, again, you have the tradition of fasting, which is still ongoing in some community, and people could not eat meat, so they would use veggies. They would use potato. They'd make a potato kibbeh. They'd use pumpkin. Pumpkin kibbeh in the mountain is very prevalent, and or they would just use bulgur with tomatoes and make a pilaf. So the bulgur gives you actually plenty of iron and protein anyway, so it can be a complete meal.
Now, you have a recipe I've never seen before, stuffed pumpkin.
Oh, right. This one, you take a small pumpkin, you carve it out from the inside, and you take the pumpkin pulp, and you incorporate it with some rice and some dried maybe raisins or cherries and just a little bit of spice, not much. And then you bake your pilaf in the pumpkin itself. And at the end, when it's ready, you can just slice it like you would a cake.
I'll be darned.
Yes.
And you know, there are things in here that never occurred to me as being even related to Lebanese cuisine, such as French fried potatoes.
Well, see, Lebanon, by its strategic location, has been always in touch with other cultures. I mean, if we go back thousands of years, the Lebanese were Phoenicians who were themselves travelers. And then excessive invasions of cultures and occupations between the from the Phoenicians to the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Iranians, the Greeks, the Romans, the list goes on. There's always been an adaptation of the Lebanese rural cuisine with a cuisine that was learned from outsiders who came and left their imprint.
Wasn't there a fairly strong relationship between Lebanon and France at one point in history? And
yes.
That sort of left a mark on the cuisine, I guess, of Beirut and the other large cities.
Absolutely. And this was due to the fact that for a couple centuries, the main industry in Lebanon was silk. And so you had silk factories. When I say silk, I mean people would grow, the silkworm would eat from the mulberries. And they would have mulberry trees all over the place with silkworms. And then they would send the raw silk to France, the city of Lyon, which is famous was famous at the time for their textile. And this was also a cottage industry for a lot of families in the villages in the Lebanese mountains. Until, of course, synthetic fibers were discovered.
So I am right, and Lebanon
yes.
always was a marketplace.
Yes. I mean, Lebanon was the main exporter of silk. France was their number one client, and so the French, in turn, invested in the infrastructure of the country with harbor, roads and bridges, and schools, and all that stuff. And that's one of the reasons why there's always been a tight relationship between the French and the Lebanese.
Yes, sadly, for the last 25 years or so, Lebanon has been known more for military problems and political problems than it has for being a civilized country that indeed it is.
Well, it's like I said, it's... what gets you there is when you're in a strategic location. So geopolitics have a role there. So,
right.
But by and large, the Lebanese are peace-loving people. They definitely carry on their Phoenician tradition of trade and exposure to the outside world, and they shine in media, in communication, and in their cuisine.
Right. Well, I was mentioning to you before we came on the air, and I'll remind you again, since you were going to tell your brother about it, that we had a wonderful Lebanese meal in London about 3 years ago. The name of the restaurant was Al Waha. I think it was Waha, but it might have had an L on the end. And I'm sure you'll be able to find it. And listeners, if you're in the London area or you happen to be planning to go there, it was one of our most interesting ethnic dining experiences, and one that we were surprised to find, and even more wonderfully surprised by the quality of everything that we ate.
And I will definitely check it out when I'm in London.
Great.
And if you're not going to London, listeners, and you want a taste of Beirut, check out the book. Filled with captivating recipes, wholesome, quick to make, which I think is one of your intentions. And
yes,
we haven't even talked yet about desserts, but we'll do that another time. I think that desserts are very important, and you give a good representation of them in your book.
Yes.
Well done, Jumana. Oh,
thank you, Anne. Thank you so much.
Yes. And I can't wait to try out some of these recipes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. You're welcome.
Bye.
My pleasure.
And we'll be back with another country right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I was going to burst into song at this point, but Anne dissuaded me. But nevertheless, we are going.
What are we going to sing?
South of the border, Mexico. Yeah. There you go. Mummy don't sing, right?
Mummy don't sing. We have coming up discussions on the cuisine of Mexico. The first one is like an encyclopedic view of regional Mexican food by Margarita Carrillo. And then the next one takes you across Mexico, but also into the Southwest United States, looking at a particular aspect of Mexican food. It's called Naturally Healthy Mexican Cooking. So let's listen. I know I'm not going to get this right because Margarita has such a beautiful Mexican accent, but it's Margarita Carrillo Arante. Is that pretty good?
Yes. Perfect.
And it's a lovely Fiden cookbook. Mexico, the cookbook is the title. And it only weighs 2 kilos, Margarita, you said, but it is heavy. And how many recipes do you have in it?
A little more than 700.
Right, which is not enough because the cuisine of Mexico is so vast. It's mind-boggling how many influences there were, how the regions differ. In fact, that's one of the parts of the book I really loved reading when you were talking about what specific dish or ingredient or whatever each region is famous for, like Chihuahua for cheese and Yucatan. Tell us about Yucatan, for example.
Yes.
And we had a book that was published, which is all about Yucatan. Have you seen that?
Oh, yes, it's wonderful. David did a great job.
Yeah, what took me back, I said, I was so thrilled because I remember just being so happy in Yucatan. I loved it.
Yes,
right.
It's great. People from the Yucatan are great people.
Yes. Well, now, this is described in the press materials as an encyclopedia. Is that how you view it?
It would need to be thicker, a lot thicker to be an encyclopedia. But it tries to touch the whole country, to bring an example of the cuisine of all the regions.
And
so this is
very
important.
Diverse. They're very diverse, aren't they?
Yes, completely.
Yes. Well, this has to do a lot with the terrain as well, right?
Weather, climate, terrain, and the indigenous people settle on certain areas.
So just give us a few ideas about what to find in which region.
Okay.
How about, we said Chihuahua is known for its cheese and cheese dishes. What about Oaxaca?
No, Oaxaca, it's known for its moles.
Yes, which I love.
Yes, me too.
And you have a whole section on moles, too.
And Oaxaca has great cheeses, too, but completely different than Chihuahua.
And what are some of the other favorites? We mentioned Yucatan, which was very exposed to other influences because of its shipping port activity.
Yes, Yucatan, Campeche, Quintana Roo, they were very exposed to European sheep passing through.
There are certain things associated with Mexican cuisine in its original form. I mean, aside from any of the influences, sort of the mother load, which is what, corn?
Yes. Corn definitely is the most important ingredient.
Okay.
Corn, pumpkin, and all the products from pumpkin, beans.
Beans, yes.
Chiles.
Chiles.
Wild greens.
You know, I don't know. I wanted to ask you about those. You have some recipes that call for wild greens. What would they be?
Quelites. Quelites will be like, let me think, like epazote, like wild spinach, like romeritos, amaranto, you know, those wild.
Right.
The word quelite comes from the Nahuatl language, quilitl, that means leafy green edible.
That's a good name for a green vegetable that you can eat.
Yes, quelite.
Very sensible.
And, of course, agave is very important, too.
Oh, yes. Then we have the great tequila and mezcal. And we have great tequilas that you can get in the U.S., good quality tequilas that you zip slowly and delicately, not, you know, crazy like in the films.
Oh, right.
now I guess there's a big support now for agave syrup as a sweetener.
Yes.
As a sweetener.
And agave syrup can be taken by people with diabetics.
Now, is it indeed used heavily as a sweetener in Mexico?
Yes, yes.
See, I would have thought certain parts of Mexico might even grow sugar, but am I wrong there?
Sugar.
No,
cane.
No. We use sugar, but we use a lot piloncillo, which is the raw sugar cane.
Okay,
so sugar cane does grow in Mexico. I thought it did.
Oh, yes.
I wasn't sure.
Well, the way you're
it didn't grow before the Spaniards come. They brought it.
Who brought it?
The Spaniards.
The Spaniards. Well, they brought a lot of things. I mean,
They brought a lot of things. They brought cattle. They brought sugar. They brought oil.
What about pigs?
Pigs, yes. They brought pigs to the whole continent. From Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, they brought pigs. Cows, hen,
but
goat.
You
sheep.
Already had a tradition of rabbit, right?
And yes, we had rabbit, turkey, and hairless dog. Of course, we don't eat hairless dog anymore.
Right.
But we still eat a lot of turkey and rabbit.
Now, you have the chapters divided up. According to interests, such as the first one, everybody's in love now with street food. And boy, I would say that in the Americas, probably Mexico represents the best of the street foods, right?
Yes, we love our street food.
Street food and snacks. And then you go into salads and starters, eggs. There are egg recipes galore. Everybody eats eggs there, right?
Oh, yes. We eat them for breakfast.
Right. And the soups, fish.
Lots of soups.
And then you have fish and seafood, which, of course, would depend on what part of the country it is. You're dealing with two very long coastlines, which certainly would produce and deliver fish and seafood. Then you have meat and vegetables, lots of vegetables, sauces, which everybody thinks of salsa, but you have so many varieties of salsa. What is the mother base salsa?
You could say that you have the green and the red.
Right.
The green tomatillo and the red tomato.
Right.
And they can be either roasted, dry roasted, boiled, or raw.
Uh-huh.
And if you make these three different, you have three completely different sauces. And it's the same with tomato and with tomatillo.
Right. Now, there's an endless variety of salsas that you profile in your book. And then the other thing we were talking about is the moles. There's a huge range of moles, too. What is your basic mole?
For me, the one I like the most is the green mole.
Oh, do you, huh?
But I also like the mole from Puebla, or the black mole from Oaxaca. It's wonderful.
I love that one.
Yes, it's great. And we have many, many different colors of moles. We have white, pink, green, yellow, red, black. Many, many, many different moles, and some of them are thickened with seeds. Some of them, the ones from Oaxaca, are thickened with masa, and they're completely different.
And you mentioned masa.
It's important that people understand that mole is not a chocolate sauce.
No, it means sauce, doesn't it?
Yes, it means ground sauce.
Right.
But there are a lot of moles that have chocolate in them, right?
Oh, yes, a few of them. A few of the dark ones have a little chocolate.
Now, I remember I spent about 6 months traveling back and forth to Mexico, and one of my missions was to try to bring back the kind of chocolate that's used in moles, and I don't speak any Spanish. So I'd go into a grocery store and try to look at things on the shelf and see if they gave me any kind of clue as to what kind of chocolate I was supposed to bring. And I was a miserable failure. I was an abject
failure. Of course
failure.
You were.
I mean, I did.
It has to be the stone ground chocolate.
Okay. Well, I didn't know, and no one could help me. No one at General Motors de Mexico, which was my client, they didn't know either. I guess their mothers knew and their wives knew, but they didn't know, so they couldn't tell me either. So it wasn't very helpful.
Oh, you should have looked for me.
that was 14 years ago, so we didn't know each other then.
Well, now you know.
Now, tell me this, Margarita, which is the most misunderstood, in your opinion, misunderstood Mexican dish?
Well, mole is one of them.
Right.
But one of the most misunderstood concepts of Mexican food is that it is greasy, unhealthy, fattening, and hot, spicy.
Right.
And Mexican food, the authentic and traditional Mexican food, is healthy, nutritious, is a delicate, sophisticated, it has a very delicate, sophisticated flavor, and is not necessarily spicy. You can make it as spicy as you want, adding more or less chiles.
Yes.
Or adding sauce. But you don't have to eat spicy food and burn your mouth. No, no, no. This is a real mistake.
No, we were actually amazed. When I started the project I was telling you about just a few minutes ago, Anne came with me to Mexico the first time I went, and we were there for about 10 days. And we stayed at the JW Marriott Hotel in Polanco. And we were trying to decide where to go for dinner one evening. We really didn't know where to go. We walked out the back door of the hotel, and directly opposite was a restaurant which failed the parking lot test. There was hardly anybody there because it was about 7 o'clock in the evening. But we thought, well, how bad can it be? So we went in, and the food was absolutely marvelous. It was Mexican food like we had never eaten before.
Yes, that restaurant is El Bajío.
Oh, you know it.
Yeah.
Of course.
And by the time we left at 9 o'clock,
it was jammed.
It was absolutely jammed. But then we had another experience. I'd be interested in your comment on this. We went to a seafood restaurant. I can't remember the name. The unusual thing about it
was that if
you ate a fish with your hands, like you ate shrimp with your hands, they had a portable wash basin they would wheel over to your table so that you could wash your hands with soap and hot water.
As opposed to a finger bowl.
But of course, it's called finger bowl.
but they said we had to eat early because they close at 8 o'clock because no one in Mexico would dare to eat fish after 8 o'clock. After 8 o'clock, they want to eat meat.
Is that true?
No, that's crazy.
No, that's what they told us. You see, you can't believe everything they tell you.
So it's not true.
No, it's not true. No, no, no. Well, our heaviest meal in the day is lunch.
Yeah, I'm more
than that. We eat a lot. But normally, at dinner, we eat a light dinner.
Right. It's similar to, we just got back from Spain, and the dinners start so late there that what we like to do is eat a very heavy late lunch, like a comida at, 2 o'clock or something?
2 or 3 in Mexico,
2 or 3, yes. And then you don't have to do anything but snack at cena time.
Yes, yes, that's what we do in Mexico. We have a very good breakfast, and then a heavy lunch, and then very light dinner.
Now, we just recently interviewed a chef along the lines of what you were saying about misunderstandings about Mexican food. He wrote a whole book on healthy Mexican food. And he said he was not sure he would have enough recipes, and then he found out when he was doing his research that he had endless healthful Mexican dishes and recipes.
Of course. Who was this?
What's his name, Robert?
Jim Payton.
Jim Payton. Do you know him?
No.
He's from Texas.
Well, you ought to find his book.
It's University of Texas is the book.
Yeah, and his last name is spelled P.
And it's about healthy Mexican food?
Right.
Yeah, his last name is Peyton.
Pey?
Ton.
Ton.
Peyton.
Right.
Payton,
right.
Yeah,
and his first name?
Jim.
Jim.
And
he lives, I think, in San Antonio.
Okay, I'll look for him.
If you have trouble finding him, let us know. We can give you, we can pass along
please.
His email address.
So, anyhow, well, there's been, I asked him this question, and he didn't know, so I'm going to ask you the same thing. I can pretty much understand a trend is hitting when I get, because I get all these review copies of books, when all of a sudden there's the same cuisine featured over and over again. And right now there's a surge in Mexican cooking and Mexican cookbooks. Why all of a sudden and why now?
Well, Mexico has a great treasure in its cuisine. And on the 16th of December 2010, UNESCO included Mexican cuisine as a human cultural heritage, as a cultural heritage of humanity in this list of UNESCO. And it was the first cuisine to be included in this list of cultural heritage, and up to today, it has been the only one included in this list.
Wow. Okay, so that's
and believe me, this was not given to us because we are very, very handsome. It's because we really have a treasure in our cuisine. It is just our own responsibility to cook it properly and teach it properly and in our restaurants do it the proper way.
Well,
as it is.
You've been
healthy,
doing this.
Nutritious, delicious and refined, not the huge plates full of red rice and beans and something fried.
Oh, I've known that for a long time.
Yes.
Yeah. But so you've been doing your whole life. You are a writer, a chef, and a restaurateur, but you are also an educator, and that's something that you've been doing for quite a long time.
You
want everyone to understand the great cultural heritage of the Mexican cuisine.
Of course.
And you should be
that's what I'm dedicated to.
Well, you
do. It's my aim in life, you know, to really spread the word of the real traditional Mexican cuisine.
Well, this book will start a dialogue on that for sure. And I thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
No, thank you for giving me the opportunity to explain all this to you. And I hope in a few years I can write the volume number 2. And Fidon will be interested in publish it and really write this healthy aspect of Mexican food.
Well, it's there. You just have to work hard to gather it and present it. So
yes, that's it. That's it.
Well, Margarita, muchas gracias.
Oh, gracias a ustedes.
And hasta luego.
Hasta luego. Come to Mexico, and I think after March, April, my restaurant will be open.
Jim Payton, your book, Naturally Healthy Mexican Cooking, is a welcome relief from the original designation by the Centers for Science and the Public Interest, or whatever it was called, that labeled Mexican food probably the most dangerous on the planet. You found that's not the case.
Absolutely.
But you put some energy and a book into helping to support that. So it's not just a theory.
No, I've spent so much time in Mexico, and I've eaten so well, so many delicious, healthful dishes that are basically unknown in this country, that I thought it was a great opportunity to collect them in one place. And hope to dispel some of the misconceptions about Mexican food.
Yeah, when I'm in Mexico, I don't eat the stuff that they eat in, say, Southern California. You know, I mean, I eat more of the kinds of the cleaner foods that you're talking about.
Yeah, and most people down there do. Is I think what really happened is that the first wave of Mexican immigration came during their revolution. And the people arrived mostly without much money, just in time to experience our Great Depression. And many of them lived in poverty and had to get by with inexpensive ingredients. And they used basically what they call antojitos mexicanos, which are the tacos, enchiladas, tamales, the less expensive things that in Mexico are sort of known as snacks. And they couldn't afford the entree dishes, the seafood, the poultry and that sort of thing, and when they opened restaurants, those are the things that they put in the restaurants, and that's what most people in the United States think of Mexican food to this day.
Yeah, well, of course, most people think of Tex-Mex as Mexican too, but
it's a branch. I call it Mexican. It's a branch of what I call Mexican American cooking.
Right, and you consider some of those recipes too.
Tell
us your process with this book. First of all, I should ask you, and this is not your first book, right?
No, this is my fifth book.
On Mexican cooking?
Yes.
Okay. Now, did you come at this from being a cook?
Well, I actually came to this particular book because, I wanted to write another one, and I had to think of a subject, and then I realized that what I had been doing for all these years is something that other people could benefit from. In other words, I discovered that the real secret to a diet is to make it a permanent part of your lifestyle, and the only way you're going to do that is if you really enjoy it, and those meals give you a reward at the end of the day for putting up with the stress of daily life. So I went through all the Mexican recipes I could find, and I wanted to see if there were enough of them that were healthy and also delicious. And it didn't take me long to find about 200.
Yeah, now, your previous books were about what?
Well, the first one was called El Norte, the cuisine of northern Mexico.
Okay, so you dealt with the regional cooking.
Yeah, I did regional, and then I did one called, it was called La Cocina de la Frontera, Mexican-American cooking in the United States, which dealt with the styles in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and California. And then I did one that called Jim Payton's New Cooking from Old Mexico that basically talked about the Nueva Cocina Mexicana, the really upscale, inventive type of Mexican cooking, and gave a history of Mexican cooking. And then I did one on Tex-Mex.
Now, this particular book is what I would call border agnostic, right? Because it's got a considerable number of recipes that you associate with New Mexico rather than with Old Mexico.
Right. What I did is I picked recipes from all the branches of Mexican and Mexican-American cooking, as long as they were really delicious and sort of met the dietary guidelines that I established.
But it seemed to me, reading through the book, that you actually did two things. First of all, you selected recipes that if you like, were diet-friendly. But in a number of cases also, you made adaptations in the recipe. So you would say, if I was making this according to tradition, it would include this. But instead of that, because I'm concerned about the calorie intake and all that kind of stuff, I'll put in that instead.
Yeah, I actually made very few alterations. Okay. Because there's nothing to me worse than, for example, substituting yogurt for cream. You know, it destroys what you liked in the first place. I did do in some dishes, instead of using a fatty pork shoulder, I used pork tenderloin. And when I did that, I said, you know, this is delicious. It's not the usual luxurious pork fat experience, but it's really good in its own way. But it had to turn out and be really good, but for the most part, I did not make many adaptations.
Now, how did you come up with the measurements? You have some very fine measurements of the kind that dieters worry about. How did you actually do those calculations? They seem rather precise.
Well, I have a friend who's a dietitian, and I asked her what she thought was the best nutrition calculation program. And then I got an advance from the University of Texas Press and bought that program and used it to make the calculations.
Good. And now, way back in the beginning, were you a cook or an amateur cook or just an eater?
Yeah, I actually learned to cook a little bit when I was a teenager. I was fortunate enough to go to school and live with a Swiss family in Switzerland for sixth grade. And when I came back, as I got older, there were dishes I remembered that were not available anywhere, so I started learning to cook so I could recreate them. But Mexican food was really a part of my culture growing up, but it was always available in restaurants. And then when I finished graduate school, we moved to Hawaii, and at that time there were two Mexican restaurants on Oahu, but neither of them were any good. So I started cooking, and both my wife and I were hungry for what we were missing, and that's sort of how it got started.
Now, you're now in San Antonio, correct?
Yes.
So that's certainly got a sizable Tex-Mex flavor about it.
Yeah, San Antonio's, that's the primary influence here. Although we are getting Mexican restaurants opening from other parts of Mexico as we get more immigrants from those different places.
Now, I noticed one thing you don't have included. You haven't included Southern Ohio's contribution to Mexican cuisine. chili 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 ways available from Skyline Chili.
Even somebody who's studied as much as I am have to be ignorant about some things.
You don't know about this?
No.
It's actually the famous favorite dish of Cincinnatians. And the main purveyor of it is a company called Skyline Chili. They have chili shops all over the Cincinnati area. And when I tell you that one way is ground meat and chili, then you add cheese, that's two ways, then you add something else, then you add something else. Finally, I think 5 ways, you add spaghetti. that fine old Mexican ingredient.
They do use noodles in Mexico. It's called fideo. It's like angel hair pasta.
And thinks I'm making it up.
No, I don't. I just think it's funny. Well, you know, reading this book, it occurred to me that if you had done this 10 years ago, you would have never been able nobody would have ever been able to find the ingredients. And now they're so accessible.
Yeah, that's one of the wonderful things. My first book came out in, I believe it was 1990, and people had a lot of difficulty in finding the ingredients, and I had to put all sorts of sources and that sort of thing in there, and it was still frustrating for some of the readers. But now, even in parts of the country that don't have the Hispanic influence that the Southwest has, a lot of those things are available now.
Well, I said, I don't know what's happening. There are a number of things that have congealed, I guess, to create this.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Congealed? Is that a bad word?
It doesn't sound very nice. Sounds like something might be on the way to being spoiled.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Congealed.
Yeah. Well, if you're making a certain kind of,
okay,
aspect.
Gotcha.
Anyhow, no, but we've been getting an awful lot of books about Mexican cuisine. And then I think that there's a lot of excitement over Central and South American cooking anyhow. And then we have that big opening of the Mexican chef's restaurant in New York City. And then we had Mexico City as the center for this Mesoamerica conference. I think it's just exploding. And I think that probably the influx of immigrants, as you said, is helping that too.
Well, that is. And also, for example, here in San Antonio, the Culinary Institute of America has opened a school that focuses on Mexico and Latin America.
That's great.
And what they've done, wonderful, one of their partners, or early partners, has furnished a whole lot of scholarships so that a lot of Hispanic kids that couldn't afford the $30,000 or so tuition are able to become chefs and then go out and open their own restaurants, and then they're not staying just in Texas, they're coming from all over. So I think things like that are also having an impact.
Oh, that's great. Really good. Well, Jim, I wish you a lot of luck with this book and your next one.
Well, I guess I'm going to do the same thing but with non-Mexican dishes on my website. Because I eat Mexican food most of the time, but other times there's some wonderful international dishes, curries and oriental food that have the same healthy qualities, and they're also delicious and fairly easy to prepare. So I'm going to put those on my website and maybe turn that into a book. But
what is your website?
It's lomexicano.com, which is Xicano, and that means that which is Mexican.
Lomexicano.com.
It's not an email.
Yeah, it's just www.lomexicano.com.
So anybody who wants to see what you're up to and get further afield in culinary recipes that you find interesting could log on to your website.
Yeah, and if they'll log on to the website or go to the Facebook page, and if they like it, then they'll get every week or so I put out new recipes and blogs on Mexican food, and if they're interested in that, that would be one way to stay in touch.
Well, thank you for talking to us about it, and as I said earlier, good luck on your book, Jim.
Well, thank you, and if you send me the source for those cookies in an email, that would be a great thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you very much.
And if you want to know what's in next week's program, you'll either have to sneak a look at the OTM audio archive, or you'll just have to wait till next week where we'll see you same time, same place.
Ciao, ciao.
Oh, wow. Something different.